It's Wednesday, the 17th of September. Here's your Biz News Briefing. I'm Alec Hogg. Today's show, O'Sullivan on Mkwanazi's libel claim. He wants 5 million rand from Paul. A fresh anti-ANC bill has emerged in the Senate in Washington. Not good news. Pressure growing on the Chancellor of Fort Hare University. A juicy takeover bid for shareholders of Metrofile, but it's part of a bigger trend which will see more companies leaving the JSE. Donald Trump goes to battle against shareholders on behalf of business executives. And the attack CEO sees opportunity in South Africa's property gloom. It's a pretty full program for you, but let's kick off with that story that is rocking the news channels at the moment. Paul O'Sullivan, a whistleblower par excellence, a investigative sleuth, has taken on the KZN Police General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi. On this channel, on Biz News TV, he issued some pretty dire information about Mkhwanazi. Mkhwanazi has responded with a 5 million rand lawsuit for defamation. Here's O'Sullivan.
He's in for a shock because the discovery process will open everything up about him and his private life. If a person claims defamation, they have to open themselves up. So the discovery process will be magical because I believe we'll be looking for his bank statements, his credit, we'll look for everything. And when we've sat and analyzed all that, we'll see what we find, but I'm pretty sure we'll find a lot.
Surely he knows that. Surely he would have been fully aware that if he goes the whole route to court, that he's going to expose himself as well. So is this a miscalculation, or is this that he's that confident that he's right?
It's known globally as a slap suit, S-L-A-P-P. Strategic litigation against public participation. Now, quite often slap suits are used by conglomerates, big corporations who want to, for example, start a mine in an endangered wetlands area or something like that. And then the local people start fighting against that. And then they bring court actions to shut them up. So quite often slap suits are used like that. But in South Africa, slap suits are becoming more common. And they're becoming more common because of the delays in the justice system. You issue a summons today, you're going to be very, very lucky if you get to court within 5 to 7 years.
If he drops the case, Paul, you're not going to let it lie. You're going to carry on with it.
Well, you can't. It doesn't work like that. So you have what the legal principle is dominus litis. So the person driving the case forward has the right at any time to drop the case. They don't have to go on trial. But when they drop the case, they have to tender the costs of the other side. So the longer this goes on, when he decides to drop the case, if he decides to drop the case, he'll have to fork out money. Now, he's a public servant, so he has to be paying for this litigation himself. If somebody has come forward to pay for this litigation, that would amount to corruption. So one of the things we'll be asking the Madlanga Commission to do is to find out who's paying the lawyers. And if the lawyers are doing it pro bono, that would also amount to corruption because they are rendering free legal services. And if you look at Section 3 of Act 12 of 2004, providing free services to a public official also amounts to corruption.
Wow. This is the beginning of what could be a pretty lengthy court case. That full interview with O'Sullivan this morning is on Biz News TV on YouTube. You'll also find an interview that I did this morning with Joel Pollack. Now, he's the man who had been tipped to to be the next U.S. ambassador to South Africa. That didn't work out. Perhaps he's a little too controversial. But Pollack is a man who is now living in Washington. He used to live in San Francisco, and he has his finger on the pulse of everything that's going on, given his background here in this country. He knows it very well. And today I spoke to him about a fresh bill, an anti-ANC bill, which is pretty much a mirror in the Senate of a similar bill brought by Ronny Jackson in the House of Representatives. Not good news for members of the ANC. The pressure is ratcheting ever higher.
What's happened this week with regard to South Africa, which is significant, is that there had been for a long time a bill in the House of Representatives by Representative Ronny Jackson of Texas that would call for a review of bilateral relations with South Africa. And no one really paid it that much attention here because many of those bills never make it out of the House. A lot of members of the House propose legislation all the time that has no hope of going anywhere. It's mostly for show, either because they have some constituency they want to appease by saying, look, I went to Washington and I fought for this for you. I even introduced legislation about whatever it was. It doesn't matter whether it passed or not. They just want to be seen as having taken a stand. But once that legislation also has a counterpart in the Senate, it means that there's a serious effort underway to build support, not just in one House, but in both. And that's the precursor to passing a bill. Because if you can pass it in both houses, then you can get it to the president's desk. And what happened this week was Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, who's a very senior senator, introduced a bill that is almost exactly the same as Ronny Jackson's bill, calling for a review of bilateral relations with South Africa. So suddenly, instead of a vanity project by people who have a particular interest in South Africa, this now looks like it's moving toward an actual foreign policy step taken by the government of the United States.
Yeah, that is pretty serious. What is interesting, he's from Louisiana, and that's where Sasol has got its big plant. At the time, it was the biggest foreign investor. So I guess he knows South Africa better than perhaps other senators. Thanks for giving us that background, Joel, because as you know, in South Africa, we don't really understand the process. But I guess this is a very significant development in the approach towards South Africa by the United States on a foreign policy level.
It is, because if you have the Congress, which is elected by the people, passing this kind of legislation, it does mean that the anger with the direction of South Africa's foreign and domestic policies is no longer confined to this particular Trump administration. It means it reflects the will of the American people more broadly. That's much harder to contend with.
Well, some very, very big issues that South Africa has to deal with. It's an interesting interview. And there's some upside actually in there that Joel says that the trade negotiators should, from this country, should actually be stepping back and just waiting for another big court case that's going on in the United States where Donald Trump's tariffs are being challenged. If they don't go through, well, maybe that means that South Africa can get off the hook. We'll see. Pressure, though, is growing on another story that we've been following at the University of Fort Hare. You might recall this included the attack on two investigators once they had been brought in and they exposed corruption, and they were then arrested by that same unit of Mkhwanazi's, interestingly, and flown in jets all around the country. It's a terrible story, but it hasn't ended by any means. My colleague Chris Stain spoke today to Grant Abbott, who's the General Secretary of the National Tertiary Education Union, where he explains the latest.
We honestly believe that the Vice Chancellor needs to go. There is no doubt about it. It is what we've been saying for a long while as NTU. Other stakeholders are saying it as well. It is clear that he is just not fit for purpose. He's not fit for the job that he's in. He says things like he didn't know. He was completely blindsided by the 26 arrests or 24 arrests that were made of people all appointed under his tenure, either as employees or as service providers. But he had no idea about it. Now, if that statement is true, and this is what we've repeatedly said, if it is true that he didn't know, then he is incompetent, grossly incompetent, because at that position, you should know. You can't have that many people arrested and not know what's going on. And we know that is also factually incorrect, because in 2020, we wrote to him and said to him, the appointment of Isaac Plykes is irregular. It didn't follow proper processes. He didn't respond to our letter and just formally appointed Isaac Plykes. And so it's either that if the statement is true, then he's completely incompetent and should be removed from the position. If it is not true, and he does know everything, then actually he's criminally complicit in everything that is going on, and he should be charged and also removed. And I know those are really strong statements, but it is a point where people have to start speaking up, even as Apalele has been doing, and he's borne the brunt of the oppression that comes from doing so. We need to continually speak up. We need to continually call out the falsehoods and the misinformation campaigns that are going on and that are coming out of that university. And that's what we need to do. We need to keep the fight going. We have written to the minister. The minister is aware of these things. The portfolio committee is aware, and they've written to the department as well. And we need to keep doing that. We're really hoping that all the demands will be responded to in the next week. But we believe it is time now that council must stop being friends with the vice chancellor. They must do their due diligence. They must do what they are supposed to do, which is hold the vice chancellor accountable. And the way we see it is that means that right now he needs to be relieved from his position with immediate effect. And if that doesn't happen, then the minister needs to act.
This is where the unthinkable happened. They just came here and took his car.
No. I sold it to them. What's this?
It's crime scene tape. Did they pay you at least?
Within 15 minutes, money was in my account.
Were you happy with the number they brought you?
I got almost the same price as what I paid for the car. Everything was easy, everything was painless.
Well, there you have it, South Africa. With We Buy Cars, you won't come short. I'll tell you really.
1.93.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
Well, the opposition to the proposed legislation affecting ownerships of guns here in South Africa is growing. And my colleague Chris Steyn spoke this morning with the founder of Safe Citizen, Jonathan Deal.
I'm absolutely convinced, Chris, that there is an agenda to disarm private citizens. In fact, I would put it as follows, that the ANC wants your guns, but not for public safety. I think that if one looks at historically the ANC stance around private firearm ownership, we have heard from President Ramaphosa himself that he would like to see South African citizens disarmed, and everything that they do within the safety and security cluster around firearms legislation points in that direction.
Now, if proposed amendments to current legislation became law, how do you predict legal firearm owners will react?
I think that if the proposed amendments, and when I talk about the proposed amendments, remember that the last thing that we have seen as interested and affected stakeholders is in 2021. We don't have the privilege of NEDLAC and BUSA of having seen this bill ahead of time and being able to debate it on behalf of the public. But if we look at what was proposed in 2021, it was completely irrational. And probably the most shocking aspect of that was to strip firearm owners of the notion of being able to own a firearm for self-defense. This after the state has issued somewhere between 2 million and 2.5 million licenses for that exact purpose. But I do think that if this act became law, The effect would be to turn millions of law-abiding South Africans into criminals overnight, because I don't believe that South Africans will hand their firearms in. If one looks at it from the viewpoint of people that are feeling battered by crime, that have got nowhere to go, like me, I have a South African passport and no way to go to another country, even were I prepared to abandon South Africa, certainly we are being squeezed from all directions. And if the government is going to insist on going down this road, the consequences may well be catastrophic for all South Africans.
Hectic news for you today, isn't there? Well, doesn't stop when you get onto the business front, where listings on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange have been falling for some years now, and they are likely to not get any better in the near future. I spoke this morning with Piet Viljoen, who was one of the stars of our show last week at the BizNews conference, about the latest of these delistings, a company called Metrofile that's been on the boards for 30 years. Today, a takeover offer was tabled at a substantial premium to the share price at which the stock was trading. And Piet gave us some insights into why this is an accelerating trend and perhaps an opportunity for smart investors.
It's giveaway stuff. And I mean, and the predators haven't started looking at, they have been taking advantage of this situation for quite a while now. I mean, if you cast your mind back just over the past few years, what has gone private? I mean, significant companies like Distell is no longer listed, Mediclinic, PSG, Aviva, ARC, all of them delisted. And then right now, this week, we've had Lipstar announcing they've had an unsolicited offer or a non-binding offer. Last week, Ascendus, Ascendus wants to go private. Today, we've had the Metrofile, MultiChoice, Adcock, Curro, Barloworld. I mean, it's a host of companies all going private. I think it's significant.
Just explain, Piet, the process of why companies do list in the first place and why they leave the stock exchange boards or delist.
Look, the main reason for listing is, number one, to offer investors an opportunity to take part in the business activities, whatever business it is that is listing. And obviously, the proprietors of that business think they've got a good story to tell and will make money for investors. And therefore, they offer investors opportunity to take part in that. But more importantly, a listed company, theoretically, can fund itself via the issue of equity quite easily on the stock exchange. So it's more of a funding mechanism than anything else. So that's the key reason why companies are listed. It's easy to raise capital on a stock exchange, or theoretically easy.
So you sell some of your shares and other people become your partners in your company, and you can then use that either maybe to retire your own debt or to reinvest in the company and grow the company and take it to the ambitions that you have.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the main reason why that happens.
So now that you've got this process of the list that you've reeled off for us, and today's Metrofile as an example, yeah, that is telling you what?
Well, it is telling you that business people who understand the value of a business, intrinsic value of a business, are acquiring these companies and taking them off the stock market because they are so cheap. That's the bottom line. And there's many, we can go into the reasons, but the fundamental thing here is that smart money is taking advantage of a situation where SA Inc., if you can put it that way, is fundamentally not undervalued. It is in the bargain basement bin.
In the bargain basement bin. Go and do your homework. I'm sure you will be well rewarded from the way that Piet Viljoen, one of the best and smartest fund managers in South Africa, the way he sees it. Shareholders in the USA, on the other hand, have got a different problem. They're not having delistings. They're having a host of new listings. And they've got a president who is wanting to make it easier for the executives of the company and maybe a little tougher for the shareholders. Our partners at the Financial Times in the FT News briefing this morning highlighted the trend in this regard, and indeed a new attack, you might call it, on shareholders from the Oval Office that'll be going on today.
Now, you may have heard earlier this week that President Trump called for U.S. companies to cut down the number of earnings reports that they put out. But that's just one example of a wider power shift that's happening in corporate America that's going from shareholders to CEOs. Here to explain is the FT's Stephen Foley. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Good to have you. So, Stephen, give me a breakdown of what changes the Trump administration has been making that are creating this power shift.
There's a number of changes that the Securities and Exchange Commission have been either making or proposing to make. Some of them quite technical, actually, but they do change the landscape. There's been a widespread review of regulatory disclosures launched just a couple of weeks ago. And today we'll be meeting at the SEC to discuss the possibility of curbing the ability of shareholders to sue companies.
Got it. What else is the administration doing, though?
Donald Trump has floated the possibility that companies might not need to report every 3 months, reducing that to every 6 months. That's a proposal that the SEC has said it will take up as a priority. And on the same day that the president made that proposal, the SEC also blessed an interesting new voting system that the oil company Exxon wants to impose, which for retail investors who opt in, it'll automatically vote their shares in the way that management want.
Stephen, why is the Trump administration doing this?
Well, there's a feeling actually that the balance has shifted too far in recent years in the wrong direction and away from companies who are trying to just manage their businesses, that they are having to spend far too much time defending against frivolous class action lawsuits that have been launched against them, or too much time dealing with proposals put forward by special interest groups who have hijacked the democratic process inside companies.
And why are people saying that these moves are taking power away from shareholders and giving it to companies?
Well, for two particular reasons. I think they add up to a reduction in transparency in the amount of information that is available on a timely basis to shareholders. And also it limits the ability of shareholders to put forward their views or to take action against management and boards at companies when they think it's necessary.
Stephen Foley is the FT's U.S. accounting editor. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Good story, that one. And another story that we are going to close off on before we get to the tailpiece is something that was raised at the BizNews conference this past week. It was an investment conference, so not surprisingly, there were a lot of investment insights. And not least was the way that enclaves are a good investment opportunity. And there's a number of companies that are that have realized this. In the vanguard was Attack, which gets about half of its profits out of the Waterfall Estate, a massive project between Johannesburg and Pretoria. And yesterday, Attack's financial results came out showing very good returns, despite the challenges that the company has in renewing of rentals. In a country where the economy doesn't grow, it's very tough to charge more to the or very tough for the landlord to charge more to the companies who are renting from you. It was an interesting conversation that I had with the CEO, Jackie van Niekerk, and that is on BizNews TV. In fact, we got a lot for you to catch up on today. That conversation was really fascinating. Anybody who's interested in the South African economy or indeed the property sector or getting a good investment opportunity should be watching that one. But here's a little clip from Jackie where she talks to the difficulties on renewals of renting and then again the opportunity that she is seeing in being so heavily focused in a massive project in the poorly governed province of Gauteng.
So, for instance, you sign a tenant, let's say 10 years ago, you agree at that stage what was market rent, you know, net rent. And then there we go. For 10 years, the rental rate would escalate, let's say, at an 8%. Now you come at the end of your lease term, so now you've got a X amount of rental, and then we look at where's market at the moment. So market is always a bit lower than what your exit rentals have been. And then you renew at the market really rentals. And that in the office market, unfortunately, at this stage comes at a reversion. But what we have seen is that reversion substantially decline over time. And then there's also isolated cases in your portfolio where you've got a difficult building where you want to keep a client and then you're a bit softer on market-related rentals. And also, as you've rightfully said, GDP hasn't grown. So you can't expect for market rentals to grow at an 8% rate per annum. And that's what we need to manage in our business very, very, very carefully.
Hmm. I guess the other issue that you'd have is that you're very focused on Gauteng and particularly on Waterfall City. About half of your distributable income comes from that that prestigious development. Has that been taking a little bit of strain given the issues that the rest of the country is seeing in Gauteng with the poor governance?
Well, we definitely feel and feel the frustration of macro services and slow moving elements coming out of the municipality. But I also think that's our strength in Gauteng. We've able to build a city and we operate and we provide a safe and sustainable spaces for our clients. And I think that's part of our big success and why we're attracting top tier international clients to Waterfall cities. They're like, if we're going to have a home in Joburg, this is where we're going to be. And we are still the economic hub of South Africa. And I don't think that's going to change. And people are saying this is where we want to be. So we've seen an uptick in especially in our office market where people are moving to Waterfall to say this is our address because our people can walk to the mall, they can work, they can sit in a park and it's safe. And we're always on and we provide that infrastructure and the backbone to our clients.
Enclaves. Well, we close off with a endorsement by the ANC president, Cyril Ramaphosa, of his political rival, the Democratic Alliance. Not surprisingly, the mayor of Cape Town, who is a member of the DA and tipped as a future leader, perhaps, of that party, Jordan Hill Lewis, took this little clip and put it onto his Instagram. So we're taking it and sharing it with you too.
Those municipalities that do best are not ANC-controlled municipalities. And I can name it here because there's nothing wrong with competition. They are often DA-controlled municipalities. We need to ask ourselves, what is it that they are doing that is better than what we are doing? And there's nothing wrong with us saying we want to go and see what Cape Town is doing. We want to go and see what Stellenbosch is doing. How do they craft everything? We need to be moving up the ladder of being good at what we do. We cannot forever stay at the bottom. It hurts me deeply when I continue to see that our municipalities sometimes tend to move even backwards.
Yeah. Okay. What is it that the DA is doing that many ANC-run municipalities are not doing? It's not a rhetorical question. Just have a look at the Auditor General's report. It's the big C, corruption. Well, this has been your BizNews Briefing. Bronwyn will be back with you tomorrow. Until the next time with me, cheerio.